Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, that's not really my line. Oh, well, I guess I'll just say it. Oh, what's good, Internet? It's Monday, September 21st, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 347. I'm your host, Rob Zachney, and joining me today, we have Ricardo Contreras.
Hi.
Gita Jackson.
Hi, I'm Gita.
And Patrick Klepek.
It's beautiful.
Just all the T's pronounced
plus.
So
A
crisply.
Plus.
So sounded good, Internet.
Look, I shouldn't even be here, okay? We were going to skip this episode because we just finished up SafePoint 2020, our charity marathon for national bailout. By the way, thanks to everyone who donated their time and money making that a success. We raised $145,000 for a national bailout over the last week. And we wrapped up late last night, at which point
we were going
to
take... Also, you can continue to donate. Go to SafePoint.stream. Keep giving them money. Okay, continue.
Do it.
Let's run up the score.
Hit 150. Don't be a coward.
Hell yeah.
But when we signed off, we hadn't, like, set anything in stone, but, like, it was late. And I was thinking, there's no way, like, tomorrow we're probably not going to record anything. Like, we're done. Like, it's time to
sleep. We don't have ad deals to honor, Rob.
Yeah. We might, though. We should circle back on that after the podcast. Anyway, though, so we weren't going to be doing this, except Microsoft had other plans. Today they announced they're acquiring ZeniMax Media, the company that owned Bethesda, which means that Microsoft now owns Fallout, Elder Scrolls, Doom, id Software, Arcane and the Dishonored series, Machine Games, and others. I'm probably leaving stuff out. So, this is a pretty massive acquisition. What do we make of it? What is the play?
And read a tweet from Jason Schreier, and you're just like, damn, you're really going to change my entire fucking day, man. Just, God damn it. Fuck you, dude. Just kidding, Jason. You're fine. Hello. You're definitely not listening to this. So, whatever. Fuck me, man. This sucks. I can't come away from... I've been thinking so much. So actually, here's where we start in the story. This weekend, David and I watched the beginning of the Jewish New Year. Shana Tova, friends. We watched Blade Runner 2049 because we hadn't seen it before. Or David hadn't seen it before. I'd seen it before. And I was just like willing to... It'd been long enough that I was like, I wonder if I'll get anything out of it this time. I wonder if I'll see something different that I didn't see last time. And we did both just talk for a long time about how much we didn't like it in comparison to the original Blade Runner, which the comparison it invites by being called Blade Runner 2049. I was thinking about just like how shallow a lot of these things that were once huge cultural touchstones for me because of their weirdness have become, which I feel like is an accurate description of the relationship to Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. And part of that is because only a couple companies make things anymore. There's no real independent moving pictures that reach mass audiences through the traditional studio system. I'm working on a story about like the future of movies and movie theaters, and a lot of it does come down to there's just like there's one big corporation that's buying all the other ones, and they're limiting severely the kinds of movies that get made. And when I look at this, it's like, damn, it's so cool that like Fallout New Vegas 2 is like a real possibility. But also you look at like the Skyrim series, Elder Scrolls series was once a huge cultural juggernaut that did not have anything to do with the three major companies that we think of when we think of video games, Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft. And now it belongs to Microsoft. Fuck. Like, I've seen this slippery slope before. It's a fucking, like, it's the slide on slides and ladders that goes all the way fucking down to the first square.
Yeah.
Sucks ass.
I think that is a fair concern. Certainly that was, and I think one of the things to remember about this is, I think at the early stage of these things, these deals tend to be pretty cool. Like, I think in the near future, there's going to be a lot of games on Game Pass, and suddenly, like, oh boy, you want to play all, like, a ton of good games on Game Pass on a new console that maybe you can finance through Microsoft?
Reaping. We love this. Yeah, this rocks. Yeah.
But I think over time, like, these mergers do tend to, like, reduce competition. They do tend to reduce, like, diversity of products that are out there. I think that has been the arc in film.
Knee sewing. Oh, this fucking sucks.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
So I think that is a dynamic of this. And I do wonder, you know, you were talking about theaters there, at what point I need to remember, for a long time, the Paramount case, I think, dictated the reason you needed film distributors and the reason, like movie theaters could not be owned by studios for a long time. I do wonder if any of that ever comes back into play at some point as we begin moving toward this subscription model. But it does. We are moving toward a weird territory, not just because of the industry consolidation, but also because I think this is clearly part of a new model of, like, making games available, selling games that Microsoft has embraced. And that is the subscription model that they're definitely centering.
Look at what's happened in the entertainment industry really quickly. Because of the Paramount case, yes, you know, we have the system where movie theaters cannot be owned by the studios themselves. There has to be an intermediary before it goes to the consumer. In the world of video games, like, that is, like, not a factor, really. You know, Game Pass can go direct to the consumer. Doesn't matter. All these people have their own storefronts. You know, it's part of being a serious player in games to have your own storefront. But what we're looking at in movies right now is, like, since Troll 2 World Tour, Patrick, I don't know if that made it into the Klepek household as
that's Trolls is a huge part of the Jessica Rose Klepek universe. And so Trolls 2 was a day where we transformed our downstairs into a movie theater with fake tickets and popcorn.
Wow.
And it was a big deal. And that
that's
movie
actually
Trolls 2 World Tour. Legitimate, like, totally decent sequel. Way better than that piece of shit Frozen 2.
I've heard Frozen 2 sucks.
It's bad. Trolls 2, like, actually has, like, a really good message for kids.
Oh,
like,
that's
it's
cute.
Yeah, it's decent.
Well, you are also a part of movie making history that smashed so many digital records when it came to distribution and, like, making money off of digital only sales, because that was, like, in March, that was the beginning of lockdown. People were like, okay, I'm buckling the fuck up. I'm gonna see what this is like to let this movie premiere digitally rather than going to theaters first. What these major corporations found immediately was that, oh, if we just fuck over movie theaters, we can make a ton more money. If we just don't have to filter any of our money through movie theaters, we can go direct to consumer and just fucking gouge them. You know, Mulan made more money than Tenet in theaters. I think we're just going to see, potentially, you know, those numbers are fuzzy also because now we're in this realm where they don't actually have to report accurate numbers to us anymore because there's no third party watching them. So, like, just, like, you're watching in movies, people develop an ecosystem that is extremely similar to what games already has. And it just makes me feel like we're making a mistake here.
I mean, this might be one of those natural, you know, when had a discussion recently about Microsoft's strategy and, like, what are going to be the consequences of that strategy that Microsoft is aware of and not telling us, or as an industry we're unaware of and we'll just have to find out as a natural consequence of their approach playing out. You know, if I saw someone over the weekend, I think it was Patricia Hernandez, made this analogy in which if you look at Microsoft and Sony as Microsoft wants to be the Netflix of video games and Sony wants to be the HBO. Mm-hmm. And the reason that analogy I think is interesting is because Sony appears to be okay being a premium product that you come for the best of the best of a certain type of variety, right? Like, it's the same with HBO. HBO doesn't, like, I mean, they have a spectrum of shows they run, but they fall kind of within a certain, like, heavy drama category and then within different genres. Sci-fi, fantasy, crime, etc.
What was the thing they said to Joss Whedon? I mean, fuck that dude. But they told Joss Whedon they wouldn't do a show with him because they didn't want genre producers making genre shows. They wanted people who would do a twist on it.
Yeah. Right. And that's that falls within Watchmen and Lovecraft Country, like that all falls into that bucket. And so and they charge a premium for you to get just those shows, which is not as nearly as much content as you get through a Hulu or a Netflix or one of these other services. Whereas Xbox clearly is making the investment that they want you to forget that you're paying for Game Pass. They want this to become part of your monthly, that's just money out the door. And Netflix has some good shows, but by and large, it's like their whole model is you turn it on and we'll find something that's just good enough that you're going to enjoy no matter what.
It's like Amazon Prime Video just being part of your Prime subscription, you know? Yes. I don't really recognize every day that I have the ability to watch Jim from The Office fight nuclear Venezuela in the Tom Clancy adaptation, but I do. It's just there for me if I want it, I guess.
And Netflix is just a thing that you turn on. It's like, there'll be something that I can fuck around with. And I think that's clearly the model that Xbox is going towards between acquisitions like this and generally their product library is this idea that you're just going to be able to turn on Game Pass and there'll be something for you. Because if you look at the output of Bethesda and their like content library from the last couple of years, that is quite a... addition to what they're doing. I think the question is, how much hardball does Microsoft want to play here? Is this something where Fallout 5, Starlight, I forget what that game is called.
Starfield.
The next Elder Scrolls, like, does that become an Xbox exclusive? Like, I'm not convinced of that. I think they could go that route. I think it's more likely, like, you know what? 10 million PlayStation owners want to buy Elder Scrolls there, go right ahead. We actually think Game Pass day one, where they can say, actually, do you want to pay $15 for the new Fallout instead of 70? I wouldn't be surprised if that's actually the route they go rather than a more draconian acquisition like an EA, which I think is like the bigger worry of a company like that, where it's like they just fuck up the culture and they fuck up how the games are made. I think Minecraft has gone. They took it away from a bad person, and Minecraft seems to be doing just fine. And
it's doing really, really well.
I share all the concerns over like the consolidation. I think this is a red flag that there is going to be a lot more of that going forward. I think there is going to continue to be acquisition sprees of studios in the next 10 years as subscriptions become like more prevalent and the way that we experience and distribute games changes. I think that is going to happen. I think Giga's concerns are spot on there. But I don't necessarily, in this specific instance, like Bethesda has made the point in a blog post that like we're still publishing our own games. So there seems to be a distance where it's like, we've just bought you so we can put you on Game Pass. Because if Elder Scrolls 6 makes $2 billion, 5 years from now, that's paid off a third of this already. And so I think they may have done the calculation there that just let them do their own thing. And maybe the DLC gets delayed off PlayStation. Like they can tweak around on the margins to goose it for themselves. But if literally nothing changed, but they got all those games for Game Pass now and in perpetuity, that deal pays off itself.
Yeah. This is a short-term, like, positive outcome for both of these studios. But, like, if you look at it in terms of the way the ownership of entertainment properties has been trending over the past 10 years, it's just a worrisome sign.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
essentially, yeah.
Question, though. So Bethesda's saying, well, you know, good news, we're still publishing our own stuff. Is that good news? Because here's the other thing. Bethesda, like, their games, well, you can feel however you want about the arc of the Fallout series under Bethesda, but, like,
bad.
By and large... Yeah,
Fallout 3 was great, and then that gave us Fallout New Vegas, and, you know, thank you. Like, please let me have another treat. Fallout 4 I thought was really bad.
Just absolute garbage, man.
And then setting that aside, like, how have they been as a publisher? I've always had weird feelings about them because on the one hand, their slate of games is really interesting. I love the Arcane series, which I guess is true enough. Dishonored, I adore. Yeah. Prey was cool as hell.
Yeah.
I thought some of their stuff in 2016 horror
Doom,
looked
Rax.
Interesting. Pardon?
Evil Within 1 is not very good. I thought Evil Within 2 was fantastic, wildly overlooked game.
Wolfenstein, I like less as I get away from it and think about it a bit more, but like it was cool at the time, it had a vibe. But the thing is, none of those games I don't think did particularly well. Like in terms of like allowing people to make interesting games, Bethesda seems like they were a fun publisher to have in the space. In terms of like bringing those two audiences and like supporting them, I don't know how the track record has been there. I don't know how much blame you attach to Bethesda for some of these things not really breaking outside of cult status. But I do kind of look at this as I see a lot of interesting franchises that now like live under Microsoft. They're franchises that Bethesda doesn't seem to have ever really learned quite what to do with or how to make into a bigger deal. And so I'm a little bit lukewarm on the notion of like those same people being in charge of like the future of that portfolio. Because,
right.
you know, yeah. sometimes it's okay to, you know, why don't you sit this one out? Why don't you, you know, take a knee.
Well, you sort of look at the tail on Microsoft support of, God, I can, the Outer Worlds for yeah. almost said the wrong game. But, you know, they have a DLC out, which I haven't played yet, that I'd like to play because I really did enjoy those characters and that
Played
world.
That on stream during Save Point with our friend Edward from Motherboard.
Edward, I'm
not sure what I make of that DLC yet, Gita, but it seems cool. Do you like detective stories?
I do actually really like detective stories.
Yeah. Corporate malfeasance, detection.
Yeah, I mean, this is the shit. This is my bread and butter. I really feel like they made that game like really, really, really specifically for me and the sort of pulp content that I really like, which is just fucked up corporations and no escape from them, essentially. So I know I am the Outer Worlds liker, but like I look at that and it's just like I remember so much buzz and such a big marketing push, like the amount of emails I got about the game when it first came out. And this DLC, I'm just seeing, like, even though that game sold incredibly well, they had all these, like, really great numbers about the success of selling the sales of that game. I'm not feeling the same, like, intensity of saturation when it comes to the very first part, like, portion of, like, post-game content that they have out. What's supposed to, like, make this game, like, more than just a fun couple of hours, essentially. You know, that stuff also worries me a little bit.
I mean, that game's such a weird
game. Yeah.
Well, it's also a weird situation because it's one where Take-Two remains in the driver's seat of a game developed in a franchise that, like, they're not going to be a part of in the future. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
shit.
It's a very weird, like, situation. And that's all. It's also, like, there's some of that with the Bethesda news today because Sony clearly made the, I think, smart calculation that they wanted to align themselves this generation with Bethesda. They have Deathloop and Ghostwire as timed exclusives. If based on past history, that means a year tied to at least the PlayStation, probably comes out in the PC at the same time. And I don't know who to attribute this to on Twitter, but this is one of the reporters I follow. There was a bit going around that that Sony had been in negotiations to potentially get Starfield as a timed exclusive on PlayStation, and so maybe that is what accelerated like this deal even coming to fruition, is the idea that like, oh, if Sony thinks they're going to, this is the big Western studio they're going to align themselves with, then let's just close the book on this and move on. So
big stuff
this big doesn't happen all that often. Microsoft has been associated with a lot of like near deals over the years, including a couple of Japanese companies. I continue to actually kind of believe that had Monster Hunter World not been a big deal, Capcom would have been eaten up by Microsoft, and Monster Hunter World essentially saved Capcom from becoming part of that mothership.
It is Fox. I mean, Fox being acquired by Disney, big, like that is the level of big that it is, and
then it's a question of what do they do? Like, because you can look at the Disney Fox acquisition as primarily being like Marvel bringing in the last of their characters through bad licensing deals in the 90s acquisition. Because you look at some of the ramifications of the Disney Fox deal, such as they're just going to stop producing 4K Blu-rays of Fox like archival titles. I forget the specifics, but basically like they were Disney is very selective with like what they produce on physical, and whereas Fox was putting out all of their titles, now they're suddenly going to be selective. Movies like Alien were no longer going to be able to just like independent theaters could just run like say, hey, we're going to run Alien. Like Disney was like, ah, actually, like unless this is part of like a big marketing campaign they're doing, they're not going to be able to do that stuff.
I'm getting pissed
and so it's like if like those are the smaller, you know, like again, I'm an MCU stan, so like I look at you know X-Men getting the fold, and like that makes me excited, but I also look at that all the other stuff. And like, well, this is where regulators are supposed to come in and either prevent an acquisition like this happening without strict rules in place that explain, like, spin off Alien. You know, like, great. Like, if you just wanted to pay billions of dollars to get X-Men, like, God bless you. Like, go with God. But also maybe spin off a smaller studio that can go handle all this other stuff. And
Give me a chance for a sequel to Alien Covenant that we all deserve and Ridley Scott clearly wants to.
It's called Raised by Wolves on HBO Max. That slaps. It is
that show
so
is so fucking good, though.
Good.
Wait,
that
really?
That show is incredible. Oh, I love
you
it.
You
want
to watch Prometheus, the TV show? It is Raised by Wolves. It is on HBO Max right
David
now.
David Grossman, this great writer for Inverse. I don't know if you've heard of him. Just wrote a wonderful article about Raised by Wolves. We've been watching it together. It truly is, like, it gives me a little bit of a Lost vibe in that I don't know if they know where they're going, but I am along for this ride for now. Yeah. See, this is the difference between Patrick and me. It's like, I have long-term questions, and he's like, buddy, give it to me. I'm here.
I know where we're
I'm
going
here for
next,
this.
Though, and we're going to break. So we'll be back after these messages.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. So one of the things I want to talk about briefly here is like what this does mean for the upcoming console generation. I think it was already clear. Microsoft's shot is this Netflix model. I guess one of the things I'm curious about is...
I just want to have some clarification before you continue forward.
Yes.
Phil Spencer has said that Microsoft will honor the PS5 exclusivity commitment for Deathloop and Ghost Bar Tokyo, which is just like funny. Like, you know, we will honor, like, we are fully within our power to like rip up those
Phil
contracts.
Phil Spencer is just like, I could have said fuck them kids and I didn't.
You can have Ghostwire Tokyo. Oh,
believe me. Based on what I've seen, you can have Ghostwire Tokyo. Like, see, future Bethesda games will be on Xbox, PC, and quote, other consoles on a case-by-case basis, which is a little more aggressive than I was making the case earlier that I thought they might just let it go. But it sounds like I won't be shocked if it's something where, hey, you're going to get you'll get the new Bethesda Game Studios game, but it's coming a year later, or it's coming 6 months later.
Or it's
a month only on Game Pass and Xbox or something. So,
shout out to my friend Max for giving me this PC I'm using right now. So these become non-issues for me. But if I were someone that was thinking about buying a console for this next generation of games, if there was a game that I really, really wanted to play,
I would be
at a place now where I just don't know where the fuck to do. Like, I feel like they're all so expensive, you're only going to get one. The Xbox Series S feels like the best possible purchase based on this acquisition and Game Pass stuff. But there's still now the existence of exclusives that Bethesda will have that we go to the PS5. I don't know. This is just an incredibly confusing landscape, and I don't like it anymore. I think it's bad.
What people should do is not buy any of these machines at launch, and they should wait a year and then see where the dust settles.
Please.
I know most people are listening to this podcast are probably not going to do that, and people are excited to buy these new machines. I get that. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, yeah, like an Xbox Series S, like even if you do like the monthly thing, seems like not a terrible way forward. Or if you already were going to be someone buying a PS5, you know, if you just adding $25 a month, like that's that completely wild if this like convinced you to get on board with
it feels like a real coup de grace for Microsoft, where they completely just annihilate the news of that Sony presser from last week. No one gives a
fuck. And their pre-orders open tomorrow.
And their pre-orders open literally tomorrow. Like this is a one of those business deals that business reporters that are complete sycophants for the idea of business just salivate over. But it's also just like, like what a position. Like it's so perfect in a capitalist sense that I feel like I have to hate it. You know, like it gets Microsoft everything that they want, and I feel like that's bad. I don't want them to have it.
Yeah, it's. It's a weird thing in that I think I would have loved for ages for something like Game Pass to have existed. You know, and in some ways it almost feels like all these various subscription services and particularly like Amazon Prime, like do sort of have the vibe of like the video rental store. And that's kind of where that experience is now migrated to. Where like, hey, try this out. But like, you know, Games Pass is much more generous, right? You basically, like, you have the game now. Just play, like, you can play it. And I'm not even sure how it handles when a game rolls off Game Pass, because I'm pretty sure stuff I've installed will still run if that I haven't finished that is no longer on Game Pass. So that's what I need to look at. But it's a really interesting offer, and I think it gives a lot of people room to experiment and try things out. And that could be a very good thing for some of these Bethesda properties that like maybe didn't find an audience. People just didn't commit to buying them. But like
the one thing about Game Pass is it's like being able to go to the video store and just grabbing something and discovering something that you might really, really love. Crusader Kings 3, I think, was the best example of a game that you should put on Game Pass so that people can have a demo experience, essentially, and spend the time that they need to spend with that game to learn it, because it is so complex. And, you know, that's a best case scenario, right? Is you get your game introduced to a lot of new audiences that wouldn't have tried it with a big, you know, $60, $70 price tag.
Oh, and also, if you, we have on this podcast many times sort of lamented, but also understood that probably, you know, games like Prey, you know, underperforming commercially, and maybe just sort of an indifference from certain, you know, parts of the market, suggested that maybe like this type of Dishonored game that a lot of us like a lot, maybe just like in the format that it's being delivered, it isn't going to make any sense anymore for a company to fund. But in this scenario, like a Prey 2 doesn't need to be the kind of game that Bethesda needed it to be for them to justify it. So if you want like a one potential opening here where you're like, you're trying to like, okay, capitalism bad, but like how can the endorphins hit me and make me feel good?
Exactly. I still like have to live here, bitch. Like, please. Like
your best chance, like it's not, I would not be shocked at all if a deal like this suddenly opens up the ability for those more niche games that don't need to hit certain milestones commercially suddenly makes sense, because there's a foundation because of Game Pass where a Prey 2, if it was announced, it doesn't have to have the weight of the world on its shoulders, because it just needs a certain number of people to stick around on Game Pass or sign up for Game Pass to check it out. And that those are the sort of, we won't know for 5-10 years.
Yeah.
How has this change the calculation on what games are funded, why they are funded, in ways that will be positive and negative? We just won't know the full scope of it for a long time, given how long games take to develop these days.
In the story about movie theaters that I'm writing right now, like the I think what we're all going to have to understand and live with is that the economic changes of the world and the way that media, like visual media, exists and is published now is going to change dramatically, and we are probably all going to be saying goodbye to multiplex movie theaters. But that just means that things are different, not that things are over. So I feel like, you know, it is a collapse of another similar system in the world of movies that led to the age of the blockbuster. And that age is just ending now, like the age of the studio system also ended. This might be the end of a particular kind of way of distributing and developing games, but that doesn't mean that it's a collapse. It's just going to be a huge change. The fact that this is changing because of a couple of business decisions is, I think, the anti-capitalist argument about these kinds of business decisions, right? Like, these people aren't empowered to make the art that they want to make just based on the circumstances they have. They are constantly being thrown around by major businesses that want to make all the money that off of their labor. That is like the sort of the anti-capitalist reading. But it is just sort of like you also have to acknowledge that because we cannot escape the cycle of capitalism, we just have to roll with the punches.
I do think this is one of the things that makes the impact of these things so hard to gauge, is it feels on a lot of fronts when it comes to media. We live in an age of like almost startup mentality of creative projects being like really well financed by massive corporations to try to launch a new platform or bring people on board with a new service. And that is in the short term good for a lot of creators, because suddenly there are new outlets for releasing and financing and creating your work. I am curious what a world of the games industry looks like in a few years where this model is really standard. And now, like, of course, everyone just has Game Pass subscriptions. You know, what's hitting on Game Pass now? What does that mean for jobs in the industry? What does that mean for what is released? One of the things that people complain a lot about with Netflix, for instance, is their decision making is really opaque about why things you know, are canceled or picked up. But even beyond that, I think I have major concerns and a sort of lack of confidence about what is coming down the road once these deals are no longer new and novel and they've just become part of the landscape. What games are still being made? What are the budgets given to them? You know, what is driving those decisions? Because that's where my fears come in a little bit.
Yeah. I feel like my fears are just founded in the belief that workers should own the means of production, you know? And I think that's just basically going to always be my main criticism, is that I'm so glad that this seems to be like beneficial in the short term for a lot of different kinds of people. And I think some of these changes in the games industry should happen, but it is driven by business decisions and not decisions about art and the people who make it.
Well, that's interesting that you make that point, because I have a piece that's going up. The embargo is going to lift like in 15 minutes or so, in which a bunch of ex-Lab Zero folks, Lab Zero, the developer of Skullgirls and Indivisible, and the head of that studio months ago had a bunch of credible sort of like sexual harassment allegations, and then more recently allegations from a huge amount of its staff about a toxic workplace culture that also echoed a lot of those earlier allegations, that resulted in basically a huge swath of the studio just publicly leaving and resigning as the owner didn't make any meaningful steps towards change. And that's 16 of those employees are sticking together and forming a co-op called Future Club that will not legally be a co-op, because there are so few co-ops in the United States that, like, if you legally form a co-op, it's like apparently difficult to get like group health insurance, because most health care providers will not even recognize a co-op as a legitimate sort of like organizational structure. But LOL. They are creating a studio with a co-op infrastructure in which everyone is shared co-owners, in which the profits of their future labor goes into these 16 co-owners, and, you know, whatever expands, they intend to keep that even with new hires, that they will also become co-owners. And so there's an example in which you know, it's a small speckle in the $7.5 billion cash transaction that is Bethesda and Microsoft. But that is an example where a studio implodes, and from its ashes are workers who are taking their own destiny into their own hands and betting on themselves, and so that in the future, hopefully that inspires. I mean, what's interesting about Future Club is that 16 people doesn't sound like a lot, but that's, as far as I know, that's the largest co-op that exists in the video game industry. I could be incorrect. In France, there it's more encouraged for you to have co-ops, and so it might be like larger there. But in the United States, or kind of in North America, and the ones that I have profiled and written about, like the developer co-op, KO-OP, in Canada, they only have, I believe, 10, because they have found it difficult to scale past that number in order to keep everyone making the same amount of money, having the shared power, without having the co-op sort of like collapse in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so Future Club is a really interesting experiment, because they're starting at 16. They intend to at least double in size, and have tried to imagine a world where they get to something like 100. And along that way, they don't intend to, like, oh, there essentially becomes a de facto elite of the co-op. They intend to have everyone that comes in continue to have shared ownership of the company. They're going to have variable salaries, because some people have kids and some people don't. And so they are not going to do what other co-ops have done, where everyone makes the same amount of money in perpetuity. And if you increase the salary, you're increasing all salaries. So they're not keeping that part of it. But they are trying to keep a lot of the other parts of the co-op. And it's a really fascinating experiment. And I wish them all the luck in the world, because if they can make it work, it hopefully inspires bigger studios to build on what they're doing. So I just wanted to shout that. Yeah. There's a feature on the site now about that, but I wanted to shout that out. That's to illustrate your point, Gita, that there are other ways of doing this that can benefit the workers at the heart of it.
Yeah, we need to open up the possibility space of what it can mean to be a laborer, and how we can labor, and how wealth it can be distributed. And that is an incredible, like, that's just not only an inspiration for the games industry, that's an inspiration for people who are wanting to make and own businesses now, that you can do this in a different way. So I'm absolutely going to keep my eye on Future Club. I can't wait to read your feature, as always.
I think that about does it for this topic. Anything we want to hit before we call it a day? Anything we want to shout out that we played over the weekend or hit up on Save Point?
Hades 1.0 is good. That's all I want
to
say.
That's literally the thing I was going to say. Is that as long as we continue on this Patrick and Gita train, I started Hades and it's fucking dope.
It's so good.
Hey, people really like that game.
And yeah. I did not like playing Pyre. I did not particularly like playing Transistor, and I liked playing Bastion. Like, the gameplay of Supergiant has always been, I love your worlds and your music, and I will make my way through it to experience your story and your characters. Yeah. But the actual playing aspect, like, I found Pyre to be like almost like just incomprehensibly boring.
I feel like this one, this is like such a success story of the early access model, right? I look at the changes they've made based on suggestions from the community, and they're always the exact best changes that they have made. There's a whole system that, based on being on early access for as long as it was completely changed and completely put in a different, whole different part of the game, because they found in practice it just didn't work as well. And I feel like, yeah, I mean, I like Pyre more than you did, the gameplay part, because it just so clicked with me, the NBA Jam aspect. I was just like, all in, baby. Like, I'm doing this. Transistor, I also found that I liked that combat more than I think most people did. I think that's their most controversial in terms of combat. Bastion, I think, is a little too fiddly in a couple of different places where I can't quite figure out, should I play on controller? Should I play with keyboard, mouse? You know, it's just like, seems like different weapons were developed with different methods of control.
But Hades, through early access, they found baby bears bad.
Yeah, they absolutely found the one that was just right. Like, this is, everything is very, very precise. Every new addition feels like they give you everything exactly at the moment where you've mastered it. Give you something new exactly at the moment where you've mastered everything that's in front of you. So I don't know how far you've gotten in Hades yet, Patrick, but I found that when it came to beating Meg, I had reached this incredible, frustrating plateau in the game where I was like, I'm going to get to the end of Tartarus finally and just eat shit every single fucking time. This sucks. I hate it. And that was not only reflected in the dialogue that you get with Meg after fighting her for so many fucking times, where she's just like, aren't you tired of doing this? Like, why don't you just give up? Blah, 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 blah. But it was, once I finally broke through that plateau, I realized that the feeling I had was like a designed feeling. Like, this was the intended style of gameplay where you hit a wall and then you break through it. And it's the feeling of freedom, that feeling of escape that you experience in that moment was the one that they had meticulously spent so long designing for me to experience. So
yeah, it's a roguelike that narratively comments on the fact that it's a roguelike. So often roguelikes don't, they're just like, yep, that's just the structure of this game loop. And maybe there's a meta commentary on it, but this is one in which, like, as you're dying, like, the game is recognizing that you're dying repeatedly. The story is advancing, like, mm-hmm. for micro stories to advance. You do need to die, come back, have new dialogue options. So, like, that's the thing that, like, relative to a Spelunky 2, right, which is coldly mm-hmm. indifferent to your death. Like, the progress is all invisible. It is happening in your brain as you internalize an encyclopedia for your fingers and for your mind. And on some level that's happening in Hades, but it is, there's just more going on that I think, especially if you have bounced off roguelikes, you find them to be too punishing, too challenging. This is like, Hades feels like, for me, someone who plays a lot of these, like, considers myself, like, if I have any expertise, it's in the action, like, sort of, like, genre. And so, like, I was able to jump into this really quickly, and mm-hmm. it's part of why I bounce off Supergiant games in the past, because, like, they just feel fiddly in a way that, like, I just demand a little more precision. This game feels so fucking good, and also seems, like, based on your reaction, to, like, scale really well on, like, a bunch of different skill levels. Yes. It also has an option called God mode, where it's like, even based on what it has, if you are just taken by the world and the characters and the story, and you kind of just want to mash the A button and, like, just get to the next bit, they have that option there for you. And so it's just, I am glad I waited, but I'm also just really impressed at the game, just whole cloth. It is just a remarkable thing where I intended to just boot it and play. I'll do one or two runs so that, like, I can have a conversation with Gita about it on the next podcast. And then it was like, I'm like on the 12th run. I made it as far as the second boss. So, like, the game, is structured.
That one's a tough one. Yeah.
Yeah. I made it like 3/4 through fighting that snake. And then I had this really good, I was really enjoying the shield. And I had this upgrade with the shield where it would bounce off like 6 enemies. And so I could just kind of like putts from the corner and just be throwing the shield over and over again. And the different weapons all feel very, very good.
How many of the weapons do you have right now? What weapons do you have right now?
I have the shield, the sword, and the bow and arrow. So I'm working up getting up the keys for, like, I think it's a whip is maybe like that next one.
Not quite. But you got some surprises that will make you laugh out loud when it comes to just, like, what weapons are in the game. And I encourage you to not look them up.
I will not. No, it does seem like a game that is, like, really built on surprise and delighting you. And, like, rewarding you for exploring and like being meticulous in a way that I'm just really, really impressed by Hades.
Narratively also, what a good idea to plug into an existing mythology that a lot of people are very familiar with. So every time you meet a new god, I bet you have a moment of like, I remember from the grade school unit I did on Greek mythology what this god is, and then the interpretation of it comes in and you already know, like, how it's fan fiction-y in the good way. Like,
yes.
Blade Runner 2049 feels fanfiction-y in a bad way, where it's answering a question that I don't actually give a shit about. This is fanfiction-y in a good way, where it's like, you know who Dionysus is. He's the god of wine. So here is this, like, swinger English uncle guy that is, like, weird and horny with you and always saying that things are going to be really randy, baby, yeah. And you're like, yeah, absolutely, this scans for me. Here's Aphrodite. She's a goddess of love. She's nude and she calls me her little godling. Uh-huh. Yep. Scans. That works for me. So you're meeting this halfway narratively where you understand the basic baseline and character relationships, so they don't have to explain that to you. And that gives them a chance to take this narrative in really interesting places. There's some great stuff with, what's his name? Achilles is the person who trains you. and Rob will know that Achilles had a lover. And you'll meet him. And that's just tragic all around. Waka waka.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good game.
Hades. Good. Very good.
Music whips also. All the music in Tartarus is so great.
Well, all the soundtracks are great. Again, like, this is like I feel like Supergiant has been chasing something very specific, and Hades is the representation, is like, it's the culmination of a design philosophy over the course of Bastion. Why am I blanking on the second one after I just said it?
Transistor.
And Pyre, and this, like, there is a DNA between all of those games, and Hades is like them firing on all cylinders. Like, we found it. Like, it's all clicked together in a way that probably was benefited by the early access part. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if they never go back from that, and all of their games going forward are early access, because the things that are so good about this game. Like, I wonder if, like, that's the kind of thing that was ironed out in doing that, like, early access portion, and that, what is there a world where Hades comes out in its normal 1.0 through a normal development process, quote-unquote normal. Like, obviously, early access is very normalized these days, but, I mean, for their previous process, where maybe I end up having some of the same misgivings, but that all got figured out by having just an intense focus group obsessing over the game for, you know, 18 months.
If you look back at the old patch notes, they indicate which updates to weapons especially come from community feedback. And every time I look at the patch notes and it has a little icon that indicates it comes from community feedback, I can see that those are ones that are based off of hundreds of hours of play, and they're incredibly specific, but they are huge quality of life improvements that make the game like 300% better. Like, I really think that this game would not have been good without the experience of it being in early access, because they nailed down the gameplay part via community feedback. They really did.
So I just want to shout out something I learned over this weekend. Co-op shooters, they're good. it's been a minute since I played them. And I think I went through the phase that everyone went through, where it's like, I'm going to play Left 4 Dead obsessively with my friends for, you know, a couple seasons. And then I kind of fell off of those. And so over the course of Save Point, I kind of binged, sort of by accident, ended up playing Syndicate, the Starbreeze cyberpunk shooter, with Austin, Natalie, and Emmanuel. Austin and I played Hunt Showdown, the Crytek battle royale monster slaying game
with permadeath
in a haunted 19th century bayou, and we played Deep Rock Galactic
in a haunted 19th century bayou. Man, that shit always sucks.
It's icky. Let me tell you, it is not good down there. Ended up playing a lot of Deep Rock Galactic with Gita, Austin, Libby, and Joel, our old friend Joel Fowler, Armand Moe, lots of folks. That was cool as hell.
Yeah.
And
game's fun.
It turns out I love this fucking, like, genre. I love the teamwork. Like, teamwork is good. Love me some teamwork. Teamwork that seems superficially easy, but there's a lot of ways for people to, like, fuck up and have things go horrifically awry. That's my sweet spot, it turns out. And so many of those games just, like, absolutely lived in that space. And now I'm like, now I'm addicted. Now I'm like, oh man, I could be playing Syndicate right now. Why am I still on this podcast?
Let me tell you about a little game called Destiny. Robert Zachney.
Okay.
Oh, Robert Zachney.
No, but see, I fell off Destiny. I didn't want to be mean about Destiny. I feel bad punching Destiny.
You don't feel bad punching Destiny. I punch Destiny every single time I play it. Destiny disappoints me every time I play Destiny.
But I think the issue for me is Destiny can feel a little bit rote, particularly in the way its scenarios are constructed as kind of like very linear levels. Like you run this
There's
experience
no
again
room
and again.
For the chaos that you experience in Deep Rock Galactic. You will experience an intense moment of, I thought we were going to die and we somehow made it in Deep Rock Galactic, But in Destiny, it's a very curated experience where they're like, you're going to do this jump puzzle.
You're not
going to do it.
You're probably not going to have the like, hey, where did Gita go? Gita was here. Now Gita's gone. Now Gita's dead. Yeah. But like, she appears to be trapped through layers of rock. And
my favorite moment yesterday was you guys were getting to the drop ship and I was just like, listen, just leave me. It's not worth it. It's just like, absolutely not worth it to come back for me. Don't just go.
So I think it turns out like over the course of Save Point, I was reminded there were a lot of shooters that I meant to check out over the last like 5 or 6 years and a bunch of them rule. And so now I think I'm going to become a co-op shooter guy.
I'm really curious what you would think of Destiny Raids.
Yeah, I am also curious.
It's such a different mode. Well, here's the thing. In what context did you do them before? Have you tried one?
Yeah, I had it run through with some friends and we had a guide. And there were a lot of things that I found exasperating about it. Partly in that Destiny Raids are long, okay? It starts out like, woohoo, Destiny Raid. 2.5 hours later, mistakes are no longer as funny. Mm-hmm. And if I'm making those mistakes, it can be a little tense where it's like, dude, you didn't do juggle. You did juggle wrong. And I'm like, because I didn't understand what the fuck you were saying about how to do this stupid goddamn, like, the stupid goddamn checkpoint.
Was this Destiny 1 or Destiny 2?
That was question. Taken King. That
Taken was the, King. I was going to say, that was King that Fall. Sounds like a fall. That is, to date, still the longest Destiny raid. It is not a good raid to be the first or only raid that you've done.
That I finished that and I was like, I like everyone on this raid crew less than I did at the start.
That also definitely, and like, I don't know who these people were, but that also definitely can come from a certain type of guide and the idea being put on like, we're going to finish this today. There needs to be absolutely space and room for people to fuck up, especially the first time through a raid that I think a lot of people don't have the patience for.
Kata was an excellent guide because he was very, very patient with us. A lot of people who were doing their very first raid and gave us the room to figure things out, to assign our own roles and to change our callouts, to change the general strategy if things were not working. Kato, I feel like I would have gone apeshit if I was with anyone other than Kato.
Can we talk about Kato for 1 second, though?
He's great.
Yeah.
Not only did Kato secretly like create a technical solution that made Save Point like workable throughout a lot of that, but I also learned something really important about Kato, which is that actually Kato's good at games and the rest of us are not good in that same way.
It's the hyper competence of Guillermo from What We Do in the Shadows. It truly, truly, truly is. Every time Guillermo solves everyone's problems and is like, I didn't really do anything, I'm like, that's Kato.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm all right. I'm all right at some games. I feel like the one that I'm best at, I feel like I end up applying a lot of these skills everywhere is because I played Destiny so fucking, it was literally the only game I had at that end year or whatever of the PS3 because I was poor and therefore if I could play a game for 1,000,000 hours, I was gonna.
Yeah, you were gonna get that game.
I was gonna
get
that game and then just play it forever.
Well, it was striking the degree to which like, in any game we were playing together, like when the chips were down, Kato would come to the rescue, or like Kato just understood the thing that people were not getting. Like,
oh, hang on. It's just, and you know, Kato's doing something incredibly complex that will just change your life and make everything easier for you.
Yeah. So I'm co-op games, they're good. Kato, also good.
Aww,
co-op games with Kato, mwah. Oh, chef kiss.
We love it.
I think that will do it for today's show. You can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint. You can check out what we are writing at waypoint.vice.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
You can find me at Patrick Klubik.
Gita.
At XOXO Gossip Gita.
Kato.
At A_Kato_appears.
Our music is by Bowen off the EP Pale Machine. The track is called Miss You. You can check that out at waypoint.zone/BOEN. But that will do it for this week's episode. Not this week, but look, until Thursday, unless we skip Thursday. I don't know. This wasn't supposed to happen. I'm not even supposed to be here. This is like, going to be an off day.
There will be a recording point is, on Thursday. Yeah.
We're definitely fucking capitalism going home.
Yeah.
We might stay at home to not record a podcast. So stay tuned. Check out your feed. See what happens. I don't know.
It's a party,
but
babe.
When we do record another episode, it'll be good. Promise. Not giving you astonishment. Catchphrase.
Did we just record an hour podcast? My God, it would be still Patrick's heart.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
1-star runtime.
I'm the Kato of executing a running show.
Yeah. Beautiful, Rob. Beautiful. I couldn't be more impressed.
I immediately compared it when I was trying to say Emmanuel. Normally, I wouldn't be on a Monday pod, but this is like Disney buying Fox. And all of the issues therein, baby, with the new trailer for WandaVision coming out also, and people asking how they're going to do House of M if there's no mutants, is like, well, here's when we get into the extremely dumb nerd problems.
At the end, she just says, now more mutants, and you just fucking...
It's a reverse House of M. That line.
Come on, it's not that hard. Kevin Feige, let's go.
Yeah.
They hit the Inhumans, but nobody cares about the Inhumans, so.
Vision, it's Feige?
It is? Yes.
I've been saying Phage.
Dude, me too.
Phage? Like Nighy?
I'm obsessed with that world, and then I was listening to a podcast, and someone said Phage, and I was like, shut the fuck up. That is not a chance. And then I looked up, I was like, oh,
Shepherd,
shit.
What people used to have. Their own culture, and we used to be able to create art and culture on our own, but then the Kevin Feige was done to us by the Solarians.
Yeah, Kevin Feige.
And now there's only Marvel.